Charles Davenport Jones on July 10th, 1960. This is the third side of tape that we are playing today. Charlie was born in 1875 and came to Alaska in 1900. Charlie, will you tell us some of the disasters of the Nome area?
Well, the first storm that they had all along Nome River, where you Snake River, where you can see it goes out, and where they have that jetty now, that just went out through the beach, and there'd been built all over the sand spit there, and they built all along the river, and along in the equinoctial storm, she just piled stuff up there like nobody's business. They washed stuff off the spit and the washed houses out down below there and everything else. That was the, but that only, it didn't do any damage up in the main part of town, but it did clean off down around there at the river waterfront.
See. What year was that?
That was in 1901.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then the, then along in about 1904, there was a big fire. It was said to have been one of the girls, and one of the dance hall girls threw a lamp and it fell up in the Columbia Dance Hall, and it burnt down the center of the town there, say. And it burnt both sides of the street there for quite a ways, but they finally got it stopped and saved a lot of the town. But that was a bad fire. Then in 1913 is when the we had a big storm that just cleaned, well, from the east end of town, all the houses that were on the seaside there, they were washed out, and a lot of them up in town. There was a, the elite bathhouse was just made kindling wood of that, and washed a lot of them out right up to the mouth of the river again, see. So that was a bad storm.
Was there any warning?
Well, it just commenced a storm, and it, I know it started on Saturday afternoon, and Sunday she was whipping up pretty good, coming in from the southwest. And Sunday night, I'd been up to Scotty Allen's wife and the two girls to church, up to Episcopal Church, and we came down and went down to the foot of Stedman Avenue, it'd be, and watched it the way it was, but it was washing in on the foot of Stedman Avenue then. And I never thought anything about it. I went home and went to bed, and that was in 1913. And heavens alive, in the morning I woke up and there's all kind of rumors, and then Mrs. Batchelor down in the Miners and Merchants Bank, she came rapping on the door and wanted to know if she could come in, and her feet were all wet and she'd had to wade out of water to get up to they were lived up over the bank, and they were afraid, you know, what was going to happen to it, because it was a storm was so bad. And so she voiced out, they had a life-saving station in between there, and they over, of course, what was called the Breaker Saloon, and that was washed away, and so they were kind of scared. So they came up, but that did a lot of damage. Then the next really big fire was in 1934, and that just swept all the center of the town, and that was caused by the old Golden Gate Hotel. The fella had it and running it as a sort of a lodging house, but he, up on the third floor of it, he had his still running, and they had a fella called Russian Tom was watching the still, and he went away for a few minutes, and the still blew up, and there was a 60-mile gale from the northeast blowing, and heavens alive, I just took the town like Grant took Richmond, you know. There was nothing to it. It just went away. I saw boards off of the flyer land on the Pioneer R building up there.
How many blocks away would that be?
Well, that'd be five blocks.
Five?
Yeah, and it just swept it, and all the seaside and around here, you can see that galvanized building sticking out in the street. Well, it was burnt from there clear up to beyond where the Pioneer Eagle is now, and on the south and on the seaside, all on the seaside was destroyed. But they stopped it at Johnny Tisak's house there on the north side of the street. So that's just, and well, back here. Now, this building, we saved that. They had a great big tarpaulin, and they put it on there, and they had a lot of water in the tank up there, and they just kept that washing down. But my house is right here. It just went off in smoke over to Siberia. And
that was
1913.
Yeah. Did you have time to get anything out of it?
Oh, I got practically all of my furniture out of the house, and I didn't get my stove because somebody had stolen my, in the rush it was going around there, somebody took my Stilton wrenches, and I couldn't uncouple it from the hot water tank. And so when I tried to get it out, they came and got me out of the house. I was trying to drag it out, so, and I got it out of the door, but that's as far as I could get, and the house is on fire then, you see. And then the next fire was, there were two fires in the new buildings. Bud Harper had built a hotel over his garage. His wife ran that, and some way down or other that got on a fire from a backfire from an engine in the garage or something or other, and that burnt. And then shortly after that, where Babe Seidenberger built a beautiful store down there, and he and his wife were out. They put the children all to bed, four children in there, and it got a fire, and they got the older daughter out, and the other three were burned to death, you see. And that was a bad fire there. But that 1934 fire was really the fire that it burnt the courthouse, it burnt the Masonic Temple, Eagle Hall, and burnt the Moose Hall, and the newspaper offices, and the stores, all the grocery stores. And it was just simply terrific, you know, it was. Of course, they had it in warehouses. A lot of the stuff they had in their warehouses, it didn't burn the way they could keep running.
It burned most of the records, though.
Oh, it burnt the city hall. It burnt all the city hall and all the records they had there from the start of it. You see, I don't know how they got a copy. They got a copy somewhere or other of the original incorporation papers, and then they got a copy of the original ordinances that they had. I don't know where they got them, but all the voting lists and all the property lists and everything else, those all had to be made up again. This again, it was a terrific job. And that was the disasters. Those were really the disasters that happened to the town. Of course, you know, with the placer mine, and when you've exhausted the gold, why, that's through, you see. And so many of these small, short creeks, why, then when they were mined out by hand, why, those men, a lot of them went out if they'd taken a pretty nice stake. And then along the third, the present beach, why, when that was worked out as far as, but they didn't work it out because they hadn't worked it right. They would lose about half of their gold in the way they worked it, see. And the storm will concentrate that now. Every now and then you can find a place where you can take out a little money.
Another pocket. Yes,
sir, yeah. Yeah, and then the war came along, and they took a lot of the men out, and then when the boat came in to get the last crew, and it brought the flu in here. And we buried 110 natives in one grave over
that
here.
That was what year?
That was in 1918. And all the boys that were taken out on that, why, I was down on the dock. I'd been working in the shipyards out there, 17 or 18 years ago in there. And when I went out on the dock, my brother came out on it, and I went out. I didn't know whether he was one of the ones that were sick or not, but when they unloaded them off the ship, they just dropped, you know, and a whole lot of them died right there in Seattle. They had the old courthouse up there on the hill, way up on the hill there, and up on the Yesler.
Way.
Yeah, well, they had that, and they took that as a hospital to put these people in it, and women and boys and everything else. And it was often these boys had come from all over that were concentrated at Fort Davis, you see, and then they brought them out from Fort Davis, you see.
Now, this was the year that you had the big serum.
No, that was later.
Oh, that was later.
That was diphtheria. When we had the diphtheria here, and they had no serum in town, it ran out in no time, and so they wired outside, and the dog mail teams They just one took it right from another, so it never stopped night and day until it, after it, they came it in on the, they came, they got it to Seward and then brought it over to the railroad, and then at Seward these dog teams just turned, they never stopped, you know, and came right through with it, you see. And
do you remember how long it took them to come from Fairbanks?
I don't know. It seemed awful long, of course, because I had three children here, and I was just wondering if they were going to get it, but I was careful with them, and the doctor told me what to, how to feed them and what to look out for and everything else, so we did, you see, and that, we didn't get it. But the folks all around had it, and but as soon as they got the serum here, well, they cured it up pretty fast. I don't know how many died. Several of them died with it, but that was a big serum trouble, see. But the flu, they didn't know anything to do about flu. Well, I was out in Seattle. You could any day in Seattle, you could look and see funeral processions going in Seattle. It was, everybody's walking around with these muscles over their face, you see, to keep them in, inhaling the germs and all like that.
Gauze.
Huh? Gauze. Uh-huh. Yeah. But that's where it took the men away from here, and then of course the town shrunk pretty fast because so many of them had died and they never came back, and some of them were breadwinners, and their families went out, and so that it cut down their population. So I got married here, you see, and I was pretty well along and married a young woman.
What year were you married?
1922, I think it was. Yeah. Or 22, somewhere along in there, anyway. Wait a minute. Is my little book there with births on it?
Yes,
that's right here. Yeah.
That's the birthdays.
It's 22, I think.
Well, one thing about Charlie Jones, he has a record someplace of almost everything you want to know.
Oh, December. I think January, December. He was born in December. No, he was born in July. What's the matter with me? He was born in 1924. That's why I was married in 22.
You were married in 1922?
22. Oh. And married in October 1922. And he was born in July
24. That's Dan.
Daniel A. Yes, I named him after my brother, Daniel A. Daniel Hamilton Jones. That's the name that's been in the family for generations.
I noticed that you have that back at least four generations that I found as I looked in your papers.
Yeah. It goes back farther than that.
The Amasa was a family name?
Well, that was the early history of naming, he always tried to give them a Bible name, see,
yes.
Along with a girl would be Mary or some one of that like that, she'd have her name. It's just Mary was on account of the mother of Jesus, you see. And Amasa, he was the captain of the host of David's army, see, and you'll find it pretty all of them that, at that time, way back in those days. That's where those family Bible names, you're supposed to have a Bible name with a kid, you see.
Yes, in this case you have two, Daniel and
Matthew. Well, the Amasa was the other name, Daniel, is a very common name among the English and the Irish, you see, and that's where my ancestors were Scots and English, Irish and Welsh, so they. That was a pretty common name,
yes.
You see. But we married, and my wife was a widow with two small girls.
And her name was what?
Her name was Sands, Loretta Mary Sands.
Loretta Mary Sands.
And the Mary was her Bible name, see.
Yes.
And we had this boy. I adopted the two girls the day after we were married, see. And they were my children, they didn't say they're stepchildren, they're my children, and by that I raised them that way, and they were so small that they don't remember their father. I was already their daddy as far as that's concerned, and they're certainly wonderful, they've been wonderful to me. I certainly have got back in every way 1,000 times for anything I needed self-denial that I ever practiced for them. I've been 1,000,000 times repaid by them. They're wonderful children.
You're fortunate to have a ready-made family.
Oh, I was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I was, certainly. And as I say, I never thought of them anything other than my children. I make no difference between them and their brother. They'll all tell you the same thing. And I went to show, they all got the same amount of money. I went to the show and everything else, and anything you'd buy, why, they get a new dress, why, him. But there was no use of trying. When he started to go, there was no use of buying anything, because you'd buy a coat and he'd grow out of it. And so we always just bought him jackets, because you could get jackets, why, you could get them much cheaper, and you'd, well, it just seemed like he's shoving his arms down every day, shoving them farther in.
What were the girl's name?
The girl's name was, the older girl was named Juanita, and her father had given her that name. He liked that song, Juanita. And the other girl, Jane, she was, seemed to me like Agnes, I think was her name, but their father had called her James, see, and so when I adopted her, why, we gave her the name James Sexton Jones. That was his name, last name, and that's Sherman. And Juanita, she goes by the name Juanita Jones, Sexton, say, yes. She wanted the Jones when she married. Why, she married, and in her marriage license, Juanita Jones, Carol, say.
Yeah.
So that's they're a wonderful woman. Poor little Juanita, she died January a year ago, and my goodness, the only thing I can feel about her, I knew what she wanted. She talked so often to me what she wanted. She wanted the children to both be musicians. Well, they are. They're wonderful. Camilla, the daughter, she's now in their third year down at Juilliard School of Music, and she's teaching. She's learning teaching in the violin, and so she'll be out of there the next year. I think she only got one more year to go. And she can play the fiddle. There's no two ways about that. I dare say fiddle to her.
Yeah.
It's violin to her.
Yeah.
And, then she wanted to get her home all paid for. They bought on one of these home loan businesses, and they had the money to pay it up time again. But you can't do it. You've got to pay it out just as much the last day as you did the last year. But she got that all straightened out. And she wanted to do it without spending a lot of their bonds that they'd saved through the war, and she did. And, well, the poor little soul, oh,
she had two children.
She had two children, a girl and a boy.
How about Jane?
Well, Jane, she had one daughter.
Who did she marry?
She married Larry Galvin. Larry Galvin was a merchant here. He owned he was running the oil delivery when she first married him, and then he bought, with his sister Agnes, they bought the hardware store, and then he bought the Ken Rank's store. That was our Rank had started the store here called the U.S. Mercantile Company, and he used to run coasters up and down the coast. This our Rank did, and when he died, the widow sold it, and he bought it. His nephew Ken Ken, and I forgot the other boy's name, but Ira and Orrin Rank were the two that came here first. And so when that big storm came, Ken moved it across the street. He moved it over on this side of the street, and then Larry sold those lots out to other people, see, after they bought it, see. But
Jane lives in California, doesn't she?
No, she lives in Squamish, Washington.
Oh, Squamish, Washington.
Well, Larry went out, he sold out here to a fellow named Hungerford. And then he went out and bought this big shore property there over at Squamish. He's got a wonderful piece of property there. And you have to go across on the ferry or drive around through Tacoma to go over that bridge, Rick, like that suspension bridge that blew down over there near Tacoma.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's all been rebuilt now, and you can go over that way, or you can go across the ferries from Seattle, and it's about, I don't know, half an hour's run across on the ferries over there. It's a very beautiful place over there. They go down on the beach and dig clams, and they swim, you know. They can just go right down in the Puget Sound there and swim, and they're right at home, you see. You can go up, you've got spring water or running water to wash off with after they wash the salt water off.
What happened to Dan?
Dan, he graduated as a mining engineer up at the university.
See?
And then he was appointed assistant engineer and assayer down here to keep the office in Nome. And then He had an opportunity to open up a quartz mine there, but he didn't feel that he had ever had worked in quartz. He knew all the theory of it, but he hadn't done any actual work. So when this offer came, it was such a good offer that he wanted to fit himself, so he quit the office here and he went out and went to work mucking in a mine so as to learn right from the bottom of it.
With the actual experience.
Yes, and he got in there, you know, and he wrote me one time and said he thought this fellow was wrong.
Of Audrey Loftus interviewing Charles Davenport Jones in his home in Nome. Now, Mr. Jones, will you go on with your story? You were just saying that you had written to Dan and...
I told him, I said, if you do your work absolute when you've done it, you know that you've done it the very best you could. You'll stop all that criticism. That's the only way you can. If he's a man at all, he'll recognize it. And a month or so after that, I got a letter from him. He said, Dan, he said, you gave me the best advice that father ever gave his son. He said, Bill called me in the office today when I leave him. He said, Dan, I never had any use for a young mining engineer coming down the mine and looking down his nose at me because I'd come up the hard way. But he says, you're different. He says, you'll work. Well, he said, Bill, if you knew my father, you'd know why I work. Well, he says, anyway, he says, starting today, you're my assistant. If you think I've been riding you, what fine riding means, because when I'm gone, I'm going to be here, and you're going to be it. And he says, when you get through here, there ain't anything about a quartz mine you can't do or know how to do or how to have it done. And so that's what he got, you see.
Yes. What is he doing now?
Well, he read an ad in the Western Mining Journal. They wanted a young mining engineer that had both placer and hard rock experience. And where he worked and where he'd gone to school and everything else, and out of 60 applicants, he got the job. It was an advertisement from the Bureau of Land Management for an engineer to take charge of the engineering department over in the Reno office. So he went over there, and I happened to be in Reno some years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, when he showed me a telegram he'd gotten from the man that he'd met as the head of the department. He out there, been out there 2 or 3 times, and ordering him to Washington to be there on a certain day in May, and that he was being allowed transportation so much a mile for driving his car there, and allowed 6,700, I think it was, pounds of household goods that they would ship, say. Then so he went down there.
And he's had a fine promotion in Fairbanks, hasn't he?
Hmm? Then he wrote me. He wrote me about a year ago, now, maybe a little over. That he was being sent to. He and his family are being sent to Fairbanks for a year to install a new system that they're putting in. That you saw that picture there with him.
Yes, I did.
Well, that was the system that they're putting in, and then he sent for me to come over to the ice carnival last winter. And I went over. He had an awful time getting a house. Johnny Butterfish got him one of the first an apartment house there. But it was, only had 2 bedrooms, and then had a big living room and a kitchen sort of combined.
And had how many children?
He had 3 children. So he had the 2 boys in one room and the girl in the other, and they slept on a divan in this big living room, so it was pretty cramped.
Yes.
So when he invited me to come over, well, Johnny Butterfitch and I had been friends for years, and I always just stopped there, so I just went down and stopped with Bonnie. And then he showed me this letter that he'd got from this man that had sent him up to Fairbanks, and said that he sort of suggested it might be a good thing if he'd apply for the head office there. Elder didn't want to stay. She wanted to go back to her home in Washington. They bought a fine home there. But when the man that's pushing you like that suggests that you do a thing, well, you probably do it.
Yes.
So he's in there for 4 years now.
Well, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Charlie, I feel that we haven't heard enough about you yourself. We heard a little bit about your mining and when you first came to the country, and you told us about the first session of the legislature, but I know you've held many public offices and you have been in other sessions of other legislatures. Now, would you tell us something of your own life?
Well, I can tell you like I tell everybody asks me about what I've done here. I've done everything but tend barn. I tended that on the wrong side, and it cost me too much money, and I quit. So I've done everything. I worked in the bank, and I worked, well, I helped undertaker one time, and I washed dishes and cooked and everything else. And I was elected to the city council, served on the city council, and then served as city magistrate when the interim office, you see, and then I was elected mayor, and was mayor a couple of times, and then I was elected, I was appointed superintendent of the Alaska Road Commission. I served a long time, several years. I worked in the summertime as their general foreman, and mined or prospected all winter, and sometimes by myself, and sometimes other ways, and then Judge Loman called me over to his office one day and told me, he said he just had word from the doctor that Morris Griffith, the incumbent marshal, was going to die within a day or two, and wanted to know if I could raise $35,000 bonds to cover the bond. He said if I could, why, he'd appoint me marshal. So I went out, and I went, an hour I had men all sign up for me. And so he dozed that 2 days after that. He died, and I took her up, and was appointed marshal.
How many years were you marshal?
I was under, 9 years.
Wow.
I was under Coolidge and Hoover. Mm-hmm. And then when Roosevelt came in, after they were in a while, they'd be pleased to accept my resignation.
So oh, yes.
I resigned.
Uh-huh.
I didn't have the right, didn't smell right, didn't have the right party brand on me.
What did you do after you were marshal then?
Well, I worked for the company a while, and I went up and there was lots of work being done, making up income tax returns, and so many boys around here were immigrants that had come in, and they would get me to write their letters in English on a typewriter, because they felt that I could put it in the English would get better than they could by writing it, see. And I made a living that way, and made a very nice living at it. And well, I mined, yes, huh?
It's sort of a public relation.
Well, I mined too, and I had some mines as I was doing, and I had some royalty coming in, and had a little interest coming in from some one thing or another. It got by. It wasn't getting rich at all. And then I was elected to the legislature. And I'd get down.
What year was this?
1947. I went down in 1947 to the Senate, mm-hmm. And then I was stayed there until 1955 was the last year I was there. And I was elected president of the Senate in 1953, mm-hmm. And that had always. You see, we got $20 a day per dime. I got $15 a day from the 60 days from the government, and $20, we got two days travel each way. And then we got 15 cents a mile, and it didn't cost us that much to get our tickets to there and back. We made a living, and we were allowed so much for mailing privileges and all, but I always mailed a lot more than the mail that I got. But pick up a few shekels here and a few shekels there, and you can make a living, see.
How many sessions of the legislature have you attended then, starting with the one in 1913?
Yeah, in 1913, and I didn't get back again until 47. 47, 49, 53, and
55.
Yes, that's five or six sessions, yeah.
You really know your way about Juneau then.
Oh, I do. I had plenty of scraps there, too.
Yes. Now, you've been a staunch Republican
all my life, yes, sir. And only one president I ever voted for was William McKinley in Ohio in 1896. And So this fall, I hope I can help elect Dick Nixon for president.
This will be your first, of course, the first time you'll vote for president since
1896.
Now, another part of your life, is there anything else we should cover before we go to another section of your life?
Well, no, just like everybody here, you do what you can, you see.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't come here to work for wages, but you had to do it, you see. I've been foreman and shift boss and superintendent on all kind of work around here, you see. I was road commission, I was general foreman, and then I was superintendent of the last road commission here and built lots of these roads, and I ran train and everything else, you see.
You've had lots of experience.
Oh, I've had. I drove team and everything else, you know. It's just simply, you live the life there is to live here. It ain't like outside, you know. If you're a teamster, that's what you are. You're a teamster. But here you're getting by driving teams.
It might have been much more interesting to lead the life that you've led than to be a teamster all your life.
Well, yes, it is. Yeah.
Mr. Jones, a part of your life that interested me, and I think most people probably don't know about it, is in your youth you played in a troupe of entertainers, didn't you?
Oh yes, I was.
Let's hear a little bit about that. How you
started.
It started out with.
Singing with a local group that put on the Poor Butterfly and when the Foeman buried his teeth to Rattrall and all that kind of stuff, and bigger students, one stuff another. And so that I went out with this, just a ham-fat opera company made up of local, and I had 26 girls, and I handled the advance man. He'd go and make up the places they were to stop where I had, and then he'd leave that list for me, and I would bed down the course and take them to the place that we're supposed to eat, because the company paid their traveling expenses, see. And then that was my job. And then when the girls would be, we'd be two or three days in a town, they'd go out with any of these stages or Johnnies, why they'd always leave their pocketbook and thing with me and only take a little mad money in their stockings, you see. And then I traveled one winter with a lady's female minstrel. I did on a minstrel turn, buck and wing dancing and singing coon songs, you see. And
yes,
all that
you're still
of.
Pretty good at those coon songs. I've heard you sing them.
Yeah. Well, and everything that they had here when I was younger. Why, all those, we had to entertain herself.
Yes.
And I sang in front of all of them, and at home, somewhere I was singing.
I wonder if the reason you're so good at it is that your father raised you children without a mother, didn't he?
Yeah,
your mother had died when you were
old. 5 years old.
And you were five.
And we kept us at home there, and our sister played, the older sister, she played the piano, and we'd all gather around the piano and sing every Sunday night while we'd sing hymn tunes and have family prayers before we go to bed Sunday night, so yeah, that really kids. Then we got older, why, all the kids in the neighborhood came there because it was a house for the kids, not the kids for the house, see. And we just had a whole ward was a gathering place for the kids, you see.
Who kept house for you?
We had an aunt that lived there for quite a while, and then we had hired help. We had a old colored woman, and she had a pretty heavy hand, and if she knocked you kittle-wise, why, you never squawked about it, because he would take her side every time.
What was her name?
Auntie Tibbs.
Auntie Tibbs.
Yeah.
What was it she used to tell you when you would do something you shouldn't?
Oh, dirty little white trash.
She'd tell you were quality folks?
No, if you did it, why, when you behave, you'd say you was quality folks, and you're not supposed to be that dirty little white trash.
Oh. I think that's why you're so good at the Negro minstrels. You have a good time.
Well, I had plenty of association with them. I butted heads with them and kicked shins and everything else when I was a boy. So I know the colored people. Yeah. Worked with them in every way.
Yeah. Your father was the one who wrote these letters.
Oh, yes.
And had quite a hatred for the... you might tell what he used to... what he told you about the youth companion?
Oh, he wouldn't have he had the Harper's Young People and St. Nicholas for us children, and he had, I think he had Scribner's magazine that he came, and he wouldn't have the Youth Companion in the house because he says it was run by a copperhead. A copperhead was a union person in the north that was fighting the administration.
Yes.
So he wouldn't have the youth companion in the house. Wouldn't let it come in. And if we'd bring it in there, why, he'd take that out of there. So we'd take it back where we got it. He enlisted at 16 in the 97th Ohio Voluntary Infantry, and right down as a common soldier. And he got first appointment. He got was made sergeant major, whatever that is. I don't know. But then he got a commission by General Wagner. He told the colonel, father's regiment. He says, "You give that boy a commission, and within a day he gets a commission, I'll have him on my staff." So that's where he got out of an aide de camp on General Wagner's staff, and they fought all up the Cumberland, you see, and they fought all that that siege of Atlanta that gone to the wind describes. Well, he was with that army, and then when Sherman took part of his army and went down to Savannah, then Burnside took the rest of it and went over and fought the Battle of Franklin and cleaned out all the guerrillas that were around in Tennessee and Georgia there, so then when he came back, and they came back into I don't know what town, Kentucky, but where they were mustered out in Kentucky, you know, after the war was over. He was very much impressed with General Johnson. He said he thought of all the generals he'd seen that he was the best of them all. Grant or Lee or Jackson or any of them. He thought that Johnson had it over them all. You read his letter, so you can see how interesting you were in his comments.
Oh, yes. Fascinating.
Yeah.
Those letters are 100 years old now, and they'll be in your son Daniel's hands very shortly.
Yeah. I hope you're telling him about putting them in that paper so they won't...
I'll tell him to put them in cellophane so they won't be handled too much and still can be read. I'm sure he'll do it.
Yeah.
Charlie, do you know anything about the noise regime that was supposed to be so corrupt?
Yeah, and the winter before I came up here, I met Bob Gyps in Chicago. And he was very chary about talking to me, but he found out that I was just a greenhorn asking for information, so I got a lot of information out of him. And then when he came up here, it was on his staking. He staked all of Lindbergh's claims on the ground that he was not a citizen and didn't have any right to stake them. And then they took that. His company is organized to come in and ask for an injunction to restrain them from mining. And of course, Alexander McKinney had got this noise appointed. I don't know how he fooled Teddy, but he too put it did. Teddy, he got that fellow in there.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah. He was just a rubber stamp. He did what McKinney wanted him to do. So he said, "Well, no, I won't give you an injunction, but I will put these things under a receiver so it will not stop the work in here." And they'll give the men here, they got to work, they got to work to live, and so they keep these men all employed, and very plausible reasons, you see. They all happen to be rich claims that they not only did it to the pioneer, they did it to the wild goose and every other fella that had a claim that was turning any money in, you see. And he was an awful drunk. I've seen him sitting on the bench there when you could just see that if you give him a push, he'd fall over, see. And being a died-in-the-war Republican, the idea that we're, Teddy Roosevelt of all persons, would be sending people like that up here and pulling us off under that, I was humiliated beyond all. Well, I just simply couldn't. It's just simply humiliating to me, see. And I was so consistent to the Republican, I'd helped organize the Republican Party here and worked every way I could to get a real organization.
What was the big, you were telling about some big fight they had?
There was a Kimball claim and hot air, and somebody measured a fraction between the two, because it was, for instance, 1,326 feet long. Why, they'd stayed 1,500 or 1,700, and so they had a triangular fraction, or it's pretty close to a triangle fraction between this hot air bench and this Kimball claim, that they call the Mondalon fraction. And they went out there to take possession of this, and they had a fight. And I know a fellow named Gitta Hare was killed out there over something or other. I don't know what it was. And this fight, I saw them bringing these men. They unloaded them at number 3, and they came down, walked up Anvil Creek, and walked over the mountain to Snow Gulch, and to get down Snow Gulch to the hot air was right across from the mouth of the Snow Gulch, and the Kimball was down, and this Mondalon was between it. Well, when it finally got in the court, Wickersham ruled that your mining location, I hereby stake 20 acres for placer mining, and if you